we're going to hopefully be able to kick off registration next Tuesday night. So for anyone that wants to register, I'll explain it all next week, and anyone that wants to start doing that can do that already then. but yeah, so just as far as the schedule, so next week is going to be the last class within our mini-series over here. Preparing it has been a real pleasure. I really, really loved it. This book that I've been using a lot by Menachem Alon is such an amazing book. I cannot tell you how much I've loved reading it. It's very expensive. That's the catch. So it's not going to be a book that I assume necessarily everybody wants to invest in. But if anyone is interested, it's beautiful. It's really a great, it's been a great reason. Menachem Alon. Yeah, I think he was a Supreme Court Justice in Israel, but also expert on what's the skill of study called Mishpat Ivri, which is sort of this approach in Israel to try to sort of develop how would halakha function within a modern-day society, particularly when it comes to civil matters. You know, if Israel wanted to adopt and say, hey, you know, why don't they, you know, why should they use the British legal system for the laws of taxes and documents and contracts and loans and things like that? Why not use Jewish law? We have a whole legal system. Why not just use our system? So the question is how exactly would the system function in a modern state? So there's this whole field of study that's interested in kind of developing it and understanding how it would really operate. So he was very involved in that, and I think that was sort of what brought about his interest in this. It's a four-volume work. A lot of the other volumes deal with understanding how Jewish law works. I'm using those books for preparing for next year's class. But one of the volumes looks at the historical development, which is what we've been talking about within this series. So we're going to have one more class next week. I apologize that the earlier classes haven't gone online yet. I hope I've just been a little overwhelmed with other things. I hope on Thursday I'll get all that stuff uploaded. So anyone that missed any previous classes, apologize to anyone who missed last week, will be able to get those and catch up. And anyone who missed the whole series, for whatever reason, who takes next year's course, I'm going to be recommending to them to listen to these classes because it really is going to act as a good introduction or familiarization with a lot of the people, books, places that we're going to be talking about when we actually get down into the nitty-gritty of the topics. We really haven't been so source-heavy within these classes. Normally, I like to always bring in some texts into whatever we talk about. There's just too much to talk about within four classes to get too involved in some of the specific texts. I may quote from some texts tonight from this book. I didn't transfer them onto the source sheet. But do not worry. Next year, you will get many, 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 many texts. Because we're really going to be jumping in, so we'll enjoy that. Okay, so let's jump into tonight's class. Last week we spoke about the process of codification of Jewish law. We spoke about how the Talmud is full of discussions and debates and, you know, questions about how different rules work and what the principles are and how they function. And if a person wants to know the halakha just from the Talmud, a person needs to be a huge scholar. You have to understand it. It's written in Aramaic. At least it was written in Hebrew. It's not even written in Hebrew. It's written in Aramaic. It's not a language which is spoken anymore. So just translating the words is difficult, let alone following the conversations. And then the question is, well, if you want to study a specific topic, there is some organization to the Talmud. But even with the general organization, the tractate on this subject, tractate on that subject, the Talmud is like this, in a sense, of free-flowing thought, and a particular subject really may be discussed in different tractates. There may be references to Shabbat outside of the tractate of Shabbat. So if a person wants to know all the rules of Shabbat, you have to know that, oh, also in the tractate dealing with Pesach is also a conversation about the laws of Shabbat. And so it becomes very difficult, A, to understand it, to deal with the debates, and then even to just know where you're going to find all that material. And so there was this process that began in the period that we'll refer to as the Geonim, the early Middle Ages, primarily in Babylonia, to start to codify the law, to organize it. And there were different approaches to that organization. Do you organize it, or do you deal with what the outcome of Jewish law is still following the order of the Talmud? Almost just as commentary in the Talmud saying, oh, they just debated this, well, this is the way we conclude, and now this is the halakha. Or do you actually try to reorganize and to bring things together and say, you know, we're going to bring all the laws of Shabbat in one book, all the laws of Pesach in another book, all the laws of marriage and divorce in another book. So different approaches to how you codify. We spoke about concerns about the whole enterprise of codification, a concern that when you codify, people will start to decide law just based on a code. But anytime you write a code, there's always going to be some degree of ambiguity, right? The limitation of language, and concern that if one is not familiar with the Talmudic debates, one may misinterpret what the code actually states when it states what the law is. And so, generally speaking, the codes were written in such a way that they tried to present the debates and the conclusions that they felt of those debates, but nonetheless, there still was some hesitation to those codes in general. But there were some codes that were written, some important ones. We spoke about the most important of those early codes. The most influential was that of Rabbeinu Alfasi. He lived in Fez, known as the Rif. And he wrote a sort of a running code on the Talmudic discussion. And so they called him sometimes the Talmud HaKatan, the small Talmud, right? That he would focus and mention the word Talmud and Gemara is really an interchangeable word. So that's, when I use those words, I'm really referring to the same thing. And so you can find in the end of the back of the Talmud, you can find the Rif as an additional commentary in the back of most of the volumes. And it's an abridgment of the Talmudic debate with his sort of takeaway about what you should do. We then looked at what is still today probably the most beautiful Jewish code ever written. Its organization, the language, the clarity, and that is the code written by Rambam, known as the Mishneh Torah. And it is a beautiful, beautiful work. He presented the halakha in the what he felt would be the most compelling way possible, which meant not incorporating all the debates, not quoting who the law was based upon, but simply stating the law in very clear, concise, well-written language. And in that way, it's a great work. It's a beautiful work. But there was a lot of, and he thought this would become the dominant, the accepted canon of Jewish law that really would just be the text that everyone would use. There was a strong reaction to his effort, notwithstanding great respect that he's a great Torah scholar and that many of his conclusions are compelling and so on. There was a very strong reaction to the fact that he did not quote two things. He did not quote the debates, he didn't quote dissension, and he didn't quote the source of his laws. And because of that, there was a strong reaction to his work. And because of that, his work was never really accepted, notwithstanding community here and there. Yemen, for example, generally speaking, it was never accepted in the way that he thought it was. But rather, it simply became one of a smattering of codes of Jewish law. Again, still to this day, the most beautiful and well-organized, but not to be one that one would go to say, oh, I'm just going to look what the Rambam says, and now I know what the halakha is. It never was gained that degree of acceptance, but it did, perhaps, in a certain way, present the possibility, or at least make clear, you know, the need for a clear, organized code of Jewish law, but it brought to the fore this this anxiety about how do you present the laws but also present the sources and the debates and the dissension within those laws as well. And how do you present all those kind of debates while also presenting something that's still easy and clear to use, right? Because if I just present the Talmud, well, then that becomes hard to use. If I just present you the Rambam, so then maybe you don't get the full understanding of the law because he only sort of presents the takeaway. And so that was leaving the conflict. Right? That's always was the challenge. What we're going to look at today is the next stage, the continuing evolution, or decision or interest in trying to figure out a way to do this, while also recognizing that as you go forward in time, there's new discussions, new debate, new responsa literature that are written, new issues that come up, right? So even after a code is written, there's always going to be things that weren't addressed in that code. So you have the question of finding code that really works, but also then obviously there'll be the further challenge that there's always going to be new texts that are new issues that come up that are going to need to be incorporated as well. And that's really what this class is going to be about. We're going to be looking at what will culminate in what till this day is the central code in Jewish law, that of the Shulchan Aruch, written by Rabbi Yosef Karo. And what I want to do is to understand how it came about, what made it so successful. You know, what it did differently than the other works that allowed it to become what it is. And to me, this is what's really been so enjoyable is, you know, you hear Rambam, you hear Shulchan Aruch, you hear of other codes, and there's, okay, there's another code of Jewish law. But when you actually sit down and compare and contrast them, you actually understand how they're doing things differently. And those differences are significant. It's not just, oh, this one did it that way, this one did it that way. No, it's all, you know, they were written a couple hundred years apart from each other, each of them. So there's things that were happening in between, and they're each reactions or response to what was done before, attempts to do things differently. And I think when you understand that, you really then can, when you study those texts, you can do so much more effectively because you actually understand what they were attempting to do or what their approach was in their method for writing the code. And when you understand their method, you can understand what they're saying a lot more clearly. So to me, it's been great. I'm actually looking forward to when we're going to be researching specific topics in Jewish law. I feel like I'm going to have a new tool in my toolbox for really understanding what the different great sages of our tradition actually were trying to say when they said things, because I'll understand where they're coming from when they do that. And it's not some of this, at times doing this is working backwards. You know, you'll look at something and you'll try to work backwards, like, oh, what did they do differently, and try to figure it out. In a lot of these cases, they wrote introductions to their books, and they actually told you what they were doing. It's actually a pleasure to read. Some of the books we're going to talk about tonight have beautiful introductions. I've read them before. They're beautiful introductions. A lot of the pieces of them are translated in here. And they just say, they explain what they're doing. So it's not really a guesswork of, oh, let's figure out what their approach to how they decide halakha, based on what they concluded, we'll work backwards and figure out what their methodology must have been. They tell you what their methodology is, and then you can actually see how their methodology translates into the conclusions that they reached. So we'll talk a little bit about that tonight. Generally speaking, they're all written in Hebrew, yeah. At times there were books, some books written in Arabic, but generally codes of Jewish law were written in Hebrew. You know, you'll find certainly some authors were better Hebraists than others, and you can see, with, you know, some of them have a wonderful command of the language. Some of them maybe are grammatically, you know, at times incorrect. It's possible, but generally speaking, you know, they knew how to write in Hebrew. They did it, and certainly there's different kinds of Hebrew. They often refer to the Hebrew of the Mishnah as Mishnaic Hebrew, versus biblical Hebrew, versus modern Hebrew, versus medieval Hebrew. There are differences in style. And certainly the words that they use and so on, which is important to know, because when they use a word in one generation, maybe it has a slightly different significance or meaning than in a different time. But generally speaking, if someone's knows Hebrew, they'll be able to read these texts. What makes it difficult, and this thing, it's actually interesting you bring it up, is some of these texts, because they're all based on Talmudic discussions. And this is something that was unique about the Ran, again, why it's such a beautiful and amazing work, is that some of these texts use Aramaic, peppered into their language. And so they'll talk about some topic which is discussed in the Talmud. They'll actually adopt the language of the Talmud, of the Gemara, when they do that. As opposed to other texts, they will never quote verbatim the Talmud because they want to use Hebrew, so they'll be translating it into a Hebrew when you do that. So some of them are straight Hebrew, some are mixtures of Aramaic and Hebrew. The basic language is Hebrew, but it could be the references they use. So it's with anything. It's like I'm talking to you in English, but I'm using Hebrew words. Right? I'm not translating everything. Or you'll, you know, go. I've some yeshivot in Israel, probably in Brooklyn also, still teach sometimes a shiur in Yiddish. That's the language they want to use when teaching Torah is Yiddish. So let's say friends who, you know, grew up in the modern Orthodox community, and then they go to that shiur, but they didn't grow up speaking Yiddish. But some of them say it's not so hard to follow because so much of what they're saying are words from the Gemara. So they're able, you know, once they pick up the key, you know, words in Yiddish, they can then, you know, follow the discussion anyway. And so that's true in some of the texts that we find. It's this combination of languages. And others, they've actually done it completely in Hebrew. So it depends exactly which one's referring to. Generally speaking, if you're familiar with the topic, then you're going to be familiar with the Aramaic words that they're using because those are the words most associated with that topic. So, any other questions? Okay, so let's start. So when we speak about the Mishneh Torah, we spoke about that. That's in the 12th century of the Common Era, at the end of the latter part of the 12th century. The 13th century is a period of intense creativity. There is a huge flowering, a proliferation of writing within the Jewish community. In particular, and we'll talk about this, there is the great Talmudic creativity that's happening among, within Ashkenazic communities, among what's known as the Tosafists, who write in the 12th and 13th century. Their commentary in the Talmud has become a staple of every page of the Talmud. On one side of the page will be the commentary of Rashi, and the other side of the page will be the commentary of the Tosafists, which is a school of learning that existed over a period of 200 years. So that appears sort of their creative production was compiled into what's known as Tosafot, and you can find it on the Talmudic page. And along with that, there is a huge amount of codes of Jewish law that are written. Many, many, many codes of Jewish law that are written in the 13th century. There's probably 15 important Jewish codes that are written during that time period. Part of it is a response to this increased creativity that's in general happening. There's all of a sudden all these new responsa which are written. There's all these new interest in commentary on the Talmud that brings about also some halachic ramifications. Right? The more you study the Talmud, you're going to come out and say, oh, how does this Talmudic issue apply to this situation or that situation? Well, then those conclusions need to then be codified in a new code of law to deal with a more nuanced type of case. And obviously there's going to be customs that develop and so on. So there's this great development that happens that brings about the writing of these codes. These codes are also probably somewhat a response to the Mishneh Torah. There was such rejection of the Mishneh Torah's approach that these codes are written in a way that responds to the Mishneh Torah. I mean, they include the debates. They include the reasoning behind their conclusions, and they're organized in many different ways, these different codes. Some are written, again, according to the order of the Talmud. Some are organized based on the mitzvot. There's a tradition that there's 613 mitzvot, so they're written by that organization. They're just broken down based on mitzvot, and that's the way that they're organized. Some are organized based on topic, right, a topical kind of approach to doing. There's many different ways, and some of them are just treaties on specific subjects at times. You know, it's not a code on all of Jewish law, they're on particular subjects. They tend to not be as comprehensive as the Mishneh Torah. The Mishneh Torah is really somewhat unique in that it addressed topics that weren't relevant in modern days, right, post-temple period, right? He discussed all the temple laws and so on. So most of these codes don't spend time on things that weren't relevant for their time, practically speaking. But there's this huge proliferation of these different texts. And that's what's going on during the 13th century. There's many, many different codes that have been written during that time period. One of the important works that's written, and we actually read last week, his response to the Rambam, because it was so poignant, was that of Rabbeinu Asher, known as the Rush. The Rush lived in France at the end of the 13th century. There were persecutions of Jews. Jews were expelled. He moved with his son to Spain. And so he ended up living both in France, in Spain, in Ashkenaz, and Sfarad. And there, in that place, in Spain, he writes a code of Jewish law about what he understands to be the conclusion, and he writes it based on the order of the Talmud. You can actually find this code also in the back of the Talmud. Many places they study it almost as a commentary in the Talmud, but it's not really a commentary. It's really a legal work that he wrote, but he just wrote it according to the order of the Talmud, and he'll basically quote the Talmudic debates. He'll then quote opinions from the Gaonim and other rabbis about what the conclusion should be, how should we decide the case within a particular Talmudic debate, and then he states what the halakha is. And so it's an important work. It was very influential. He was a student of one of the great halakhic authorities from France, and so he, in a certain sense, is like a great reservoir of knowledge about halakha as it was understood within Ashkenaz. But he also lived in Spain, and so he was a rabbi there as well, and so he's also familiar with what was generally known, right, as the more Spanish tradition of psak, of halakha, as well. And so it's a very important work. However, it's organized according to the Talmud. It's not so easy. If you want to know a particular halakha, where exactly do you go? Right? It didn't solve the problem of having a code that would really be helpful. And so his son will create a code that will become a very influential code and will actually create the framework that ultimately Rabbi Yosef Karo will follow when he writes the Shulchan Aruch that will become the major code in Jewish law. So let's talk a little bit about it. We actually have it on the shelf over there. It's the fourth row down. It's almost the entire row. You can see is one volume of work. That is that right there. That is known as the Torah. It's written by Yaakov ben Asher, Jacob the son of Asher, this Rabbeinu Asher that we were talking about. So, yes. No, the Torah is written by Yaakov ben Asher in the 14th century. Shulchan Aruch will be written in the 16th century by Rabbi Yosef Karo.
It's called the Torah?
It's called the Torah. Torah means the Rav. Yeah. Now, it's really an abbreviation of Arba'a Turim, the four rows, because he breaks all of halakha down into four categories, which we're going to get to in a moment. Okay, we'll talk about the categories in a moment. But what he does in this work, and that's what's going to allow it to be an important text, is he starts any topic of halakha that he covers with stating what the law is. And then following the law, he then quotes the Talmudic debate. He quotes the different opinions and how he concludes. Oftentimes, when it's the way he'll conclude is based on what his father had said, right? His father was this great scholar. What his father usually concluded will be the conclusion that he will generally accept. But he presents it in a way which is easier to follow because it's going to be organized based on subject, but it also operates as a good code because it starts with what the law is and then explains the discussions and the debates about it. And so it, in a certain sense, pushes off the debate about, oh, was it, you know, does, how can you write a code? It doesn't incorporate the traditions of the different debates about a topic. No, because he incorporates those debates, but he also presents what the conclusion is. But he also makes it into a useful text because it's organized based on subject matter, as opposed to being organized simply, you know, as almost as a commentary on the Talmudic discussion. And so in that way it becomes a really important work. One of the things also it does is it takes into account a lot of these other texts that have been written. He takes into account different responsa literature. So it also, it has a lot more information to deal with than, let's say, earlier codes had to do with, because it's written a couple hundred years later. So it's an important text because it all of a sudden is combining a lot of earlier types of traditions. Now, as we're going to see, there are going to be those that aren't going to like it. The Shulchan Aruch is going to feel like it's not sufficient because he feels he doesn't always take into account the position of Rambam. He doesn't always take into account the position of the Rif. The Rambam, the Rif, right, great Sephardic commentaries, Tor, while written in Spain, right, his family heritage is Ashkenaz. He does often quote Rambam. He does often quote Rif and so on, but there'll be this feeling that perhaps he doesn't give enough weight to those rabbis. He gives greater weight to his father, and there'll be that sense of, oh, maybe another code needs to be written. We'll talk about the Shulchan Aruch and some of his motivations in a moment. What I want to talk about, though, now for just a few moments, is the organization of the Torah, because it's a really important organization in what he sets forth. It's really, it shows his great mastery of the subject matter, his great organization skills, which is really interesting in of itself, but it will also be then the template that Rabbi Yosef Cairo will adopt for writing his work, the Shulchan Aruch. And so he splits the law into four categories. And I wrote them here on your sheet under organization. The first one is Orach Chayim, the way or the path of life. And the laws that are included within Orach Chayim are laws that are generally relate to daily living. Oh, sorry, right at the over there. Right, it deals with things of daily living, the laws of prayer, the laws of things you do when you wake up in the morning, laws of Shabbat, laws of the holidays. Right, things that are regular occurrence. Right, everybody deals with these issues on a regular basis. Right, these different kinds of religious rituals, and so on. Right, all the holidays, Shabbat, daily living. Right, those are the things that are going to be included in Orach Chayim. He then has another category known as Yored De'ah, the teaching of knowledge. And this teaching of knowledge deals with the laws of kashrut, the laws of what is permitted and what is prohibited. And the laws of kashrut deal with slaughter an animal, how do you check to make sure the organs of the animal are kosher, how do you salt the meats, what do you do when it comes to the laws of separating milk and meat, what if things get mixed together, what about pots and pans, right? All the laws dealing with those kinds of matters are addressed within this section of his law code. He then has a section called Evan Ha'ezer, the stone helper. Ezer. These laws, we'll talk about the name in a moment, it's actually a cute name, these laws deal primarily with things related to marriage. The laws related to marriage. Now, you know, what is the reference to a woman in marriage in the Bible? How is Eve referred to? Ezer Kenegdo, right? She is the helpmate opposite him. Right? The whole debate was being opposite him, right? Sometimes a woman is most help when she disagrees with you, right? In any case, you worked alongside each other. In any case, a woman is referred to as the helpmate. So here, what exactly the reference of the stone, the stone help? It's a discussion what exactly he refers to, but there's something solid about it, right? So in here, he talks about the laws of marriage contracts, right? The ketuvah, the laws of how a marriage actually happens, right? What are the laws of chupa and the laws of how you actually do the marriage ceremony, obviously the laws of divorce. All these kinds of laws are discussed within this section of the law. And then he has what actually seems to be the largest of all of his sections, is Choshen Mishpat, which is based on the breastplate that the Kohen Gadol wore, right? And it was considered to be like the source of knowledge from God, right? That was the way God would communicate. And in there are all the civil laws. How courts function, what are the laws relating to witnesses, cross-examination, loans, damages, property values, transactions, right? All those kinds of laws are dealt with in Choshen Mishpat. He breaks it down into four categories. Within each of these turim, these rows, as each of these categories are called, that's why the book was called the Arvat Turim, the four rows, short, the tour. He broke it down into general categories called halakhot, but more specifically, the way that it's really used is within each of these turim, within each of these sections of the law, he broke it down based on smaller categories known as the simanim, the siman, the sign, and within each siman are many, and this is a question whether this was really adopted by him or maybe added later, because maybe something that the Shulchan Aruch actually added, but I'll just introduce it now, is the notion of the si'if as well. So you have the siman, which is the category, and within each siman, maybe 10 si'ifim, maybe 3 si'ifim, maybe 25 si'ifim, right? That break it down depending on just how many different things there are to talk about. And so within each tour, there could be 350 simanim, and within each siman, 10, 15 si'ifim, right? So it's si'if. I'm actually forgetting what the specific translation is. I apologize.
You'd have to see what it is. If you see what it is, you would understand
that.
Without trying to
any work, I'll tell you next week. I'll look it up. I forget what the translation is. Okay. But at the end of the day, it just means like the specific law, right? That's what's going to be, right? You're going to have a collection of laws in any particular subject. So the subject will be the siman. The specific law will be each si'if. Will be another specific law within that category that you're talking about. And so it's obviously many, it's very large, and so he has a lot of different categories. He has a lot of different categories that he breaks things down to. It's much more precise categorization than, let's say, for example, the Rambam's Mishneh Torah. Some people think almost that he went overboard. He broke it down into too many categories. You know, he tried to make it too specific. Though I don't know that too much specificity can ever really be a problem. The Shulchan Aruch is actually going to dial it back a little bit when he does his. But he certainly does create this very organized kind of system. You want to find something, it's much easier to find it now, and it's sort of this reorganization of the material, right? How he decides that the material should be presented, should be organized, and then the organization itself tells you a lot about the way that he thinks about the laws. And so, you know, whenever it's looking at a particular law, you're going to want to see, oh, how did this particular code organize these laws, right? According in the Rambam, when he presents civil laws, he tends to present all the laws themselves first, and then the NT presents the laws that govern how a court functions. And here, the laws of how the court function are presented first, and then afterwards are the laws themselves. So, is that significant? I don't know. But the different approaches to how to organize it, and sometimes how you organize things can, in of itself, tell you a little bit about how the person thought about the areas of law as well. Yeah.
It seems to me that the code goes way beyond the sources.
So he does. No, it's based on, again, at this point, there's this huge amount of information that has been written. So there's all these codes that have been put together. There's response. There's not just Talmud. It's the Talmud plus everything that's been written since the Talmud. But he tells you. He quotes them. It's an amazing work. It's really good. You know, it states you with the laws without quoting people. He just says this is the, but then gives you this whole, all this information. And so it's a really great, it's a beautiful work. It's a really, really beautiful work. Yeah. Let's go on now. So that's the tour. The Shulchan Aruch comes 2 centuries later, in the 16th century. Anytime you talk about a code, it's always a question, why exactly was another code written? So one approach is that usually they come, after some calamity and a need to consolidate, reorganize. That's one approach. Another approach is that they come at that when all of a sudden there's, after one code is written, there's all these commentaries written on the codes. So all of a sudden that becomes so unwieldy, someone needs to write a new code. Right? So that's another approach about why exactly codes are written. Maybe it's a combination of the two factors that bring about when another major code is put together. So in this situation, there's both of those things are certainly the case. When we think about the things that happened between the 14th and the 16th century, is basically there's been major upheaval in the entire Jewish world. Both Ashkenazic Jewish communities and Sephardic Jewish communities have been uprooted, right? And in a certain sense, similar to this past century, right? Everyone has been uprooted. Following the Black Death in Europe in the middle of the 14th century, terrible persecutions on Ashkenazi Jews, and there's a movement of Jewish communities from Western Europe to Eastern Europe. There's probably already been Jews there from beforehand, but when we start thinking about, when did all the Jews get to Poland? This is when it really starts to grow, right? It's during the latter part of the 14th, 15th, 16th century is when you have the major development of all the famous Jewish communities of Krakow and Vilna and so on in Eastern Europe. And with that, the new centers of Torah learning and great yeshivot that will be established in those places. Of course, throughout the 14th and then at the end of the 15th century in Spain are terrible persecutions, culminating in the expulsion in 1492, and that will drive Jews out of Spain and into places like North Africa, into the Ottoman Empire, into Israel, and the communities will move into those areas as well. So there's been a major upheaval throughout the Jewish world. It's also been 200 years, so there's just in general more writing, but it also seems that there's been this more intensive interest in creativity, in trying to connect to Torah, a sense of, everything is out of order, but this is what focuses us. There's messianic fervor that we know that takes place during that time, and there's this intensive interest in applying halakha and understanding the halakha as accurately as possible. With that comes a person who himself was 4 years old in 1492, His family ends up, after moving to 6 different places, in Safed, Yosef Cairo. In Safed, Yosef Cairo will become a great rabbi and will write what to this day is probably the most important Jewish code, the Shulchan Aruch. If you open up the Shulchan Aruch, it should have the same problem that the Rambam had. It's just listing laws. This law, that law, the other law, doesn't quote who said it, doesn't quote all the different opinions. It most of the time just states what the law is. So why did it make it? Because he wrote a sister book. And this is the significance. He wrote 2 books that were meant to be companion texts to each other. He wrote a commentary on the Torah called Bet Yosef. You can find it in that in any set of the Torah that one purchases. And in that commentary, the Beit Yosef, which he considered right? This is significant. He considered that to be the more important of both of the texts that he wrote. Because in the Beit Yosef, he basically decides, I'm not going to write a new book, because the Torah already quotes a lot of the sources. He says, you know what, I'm just going to write something, a commentary on the Torah, where I'm going to add all the things that he left out. And so I'll make sure that, oh, if there's an important Rambam, or an important Rif, or another important response or text that the Torah didn't take into account, or perhaps because of that, I feel like he reached the improper conclusion, I'm going to bring that in. And so the Torah is this compendium, sorry, the Beit Yosef is this compendium of all the sources, and then a discussion about them, an analysis of those sources. And it's a beautiful text that can be long. But if a person wants to study the halakha, a great place to start is the Torah Beit Yosef, because that's where you're going to see all the sources. So you don't have to sit there opening up 50 different books. He's going to quote them for you. And you can actually see all the texts together. It's an incredibly impressive work. It's really beautiful work. The conclusions that he reaches in the Beit Yosef are what appear in the Shulchan Aruch, or what appear in the Karokos. And so in that way, he was able to deflect, you know, the criticisms that the Rambam had to deal with, because yes, he wrote it in just code form, but he has another book where he gave you the reasons that he reached all of those conclusions. So if a person wanted to understand what he wrote in the Shulchan Aruch more accurately, to understand what does he mean when he says this, you could go back, look in the Beit Yosef, see over there the whole discussion about it, and through that, make sure really understand the conclusion that he reached. Now, I'm going to switch. Yes?
Can you just give the meaning of the
Bible Confession? Oh, sorry. So, Beit Yosef means the house of Joseph. His name was Joseph Caro. So, he called it the house of Joseph. The book, Shulchan Aruch, means the set table. Right? So, the set table. He set the table for us. You just need to sit down and eat. He's done all the work for you. Okay? It's a great name. Okay? So the organization that he follows is basically the organization of the Torah, the basic four sections, and then broken down into these simanim, broken down to si'ifim. He maybe has it less simanim than the Torah did, and so on. So it's a little different, but the general organization is the same. We'll be familiar. And again, the reason I think he did that is because he wrote his commentary on the Torah. He said, why should I have to write down everything again? The Torah, he wrote part of it. So once he wrote his commentary on the Torah, if he wanted it to really be a companion text, so you can't then write your code based on a different organization than the source of your code, if you want people to be able to compare, you know, to use one as a resource for the other. So he basically adopts the same organization method of Yaakov ben Asher in his work, the Torah. Okay. And what's interesting about his work is he sets out a methodology, and this is going to be controversial. He presents an approach. He goes, there's so many opinions out there. How do I know how to conclude? How do you know? And this is going to be important. We're going to discuss this a lot next week when we're going to look at more contemporary psak, more contemporary legal issues. This is going to be an important debate that we're going to be addressing. And it's still an ongoing, I would say, debate today. And the question is, how do you conclude? You have all these opinions. Who are you to distinguish and to say who's right between Rabbeinu Asher and the Rambam? Between the Rif and Tosafot? And so the Rabbi Yosef Karo says, I'm not going to get involved in the debate. He's, I'm not going to get involved in the debate because how can I really distinguish between them? The amount of commentary that I would need to write in order to really evaluate and come to the conclusion which approach do I really think is the more compelling approach, I would never finish. It would be such an exhaustive approach. So he says, I'm going to arrive at a conclusion based on the following criteria. He says, I'm going to take three people. I'm going to take the Rambam. I'm going to take Rabbeinu Alfasi, the author of the Rif, and I'm going to take Rabbeinu Asher, the author of the Rush, and I'm going to choose how to conclude based on majority rules. Right? It's an approach within the Talmud, within the Torah, that says, Acharei Rabim Lahatot, after the majority shall rule. So he's like, those are the three people that will be the ones that will govern how it is that I should conclude. I'm going to take best out of three. What if a particular topic they don't all comment on? And so then you have one against one. So then he says, we're going to go to the next tier. And then he identifies five other important halachic works. And he says, I'll use those five to help me reach the conclusion. And basically, that's his method for figuring out how it is that things should be concluded. And he says, this is necessary. He says, there's been such an explosion of texts. He goes, nobody has any idea what to do anymore. I mentioned, he quotes in his introduction 15 different halachic works that were written within the preceding 200, 300 years, 400 years. He says, no one has any clue what to do. He says, we've got to figure it out. And so he says, this is the approach we're going to take in order to figure it out. I'm just going to collect it all together, and we're going to go based on majority rule, based on these giants. Yes?
During all this time, Jewish communities are existing. What are they going by?
Now, so it's a good point. So at a certain time when the communities were in one spot, so if the rabbi of your community wrote a legal work, you probably were following his book. Right? I mean, these rabbis lived in different communities. So probably whichever rabbi in your area was the most influential that had written a work probably was the one that was determining it. But you can imagine now everyone's been uprooted and moved around. So again, you basically know how to be Jewish. But the question is, what about when it comes to real legal decisions, especially when it comes to civil matters and things like that? When it comes to civil matters, there's added complications. So there's this need to say, you know, there's so much out there. No one really knows what to do. Most of these other books are very complicated. Some are really well written. A lot of them are confusing. So we've got to do something. And he figures this is going to be the best approach to take. And that's what he does. That's what he does. In Beit Yosef, he goes through the whole discussion, he quotes all the sources, and basically through that, you see where he concludes, and usually can connect that to what you find in the Shulchan Aruch. Once in a while, what he seems to conclude in the Beit Yosef doesn't score with what he says in the Shulchan Aruch, and that's always the interesting discussion of like, hey, what's going on here? But usually it does. Usually it matches up.
He tends to quote
all of them. He tends to quote whatever was left out. Because again, sometimes not everything is talked about in every person, so you need to bring it all together. Yes?
Over this 200 to 400 year period,
yeah.
When were the first compendiums or codes that were being printed?
So the printing, that's a good question. That's going to be one of the reasons, perhaps, for part of the success of the Shulchan Aruch. The printing press is what? In the end of the 15th century? So this is in the 16th century. So this is really... So not many. We know one of the first books, Jewish books. I think there's two Jewish books that are on the printing press, or commentaries. One is Rashi's commentary on Torah. Not surprising. And the other one is the Torah. Those are the two first. So, obviously besides for the Bible. So, that's... just give you a sense of how significant the Torah was. It was a really significant work. And again, maybe that's also part of the reason the Shulchan Aruch decided to write on it. I mean, that was one of the books that had been run on the printing press.
Does that mean that with Rabbeinu Asher, it was like one copy and
that... Yeah, you're a copyist. How did people do books back then? You're a copyist.
Passed it around the...
Other people wrote copies. You had scribes, people who were copyists, and things like that. That's why, in a lot of you read a lot of these books. There's often questions of, oh, they call it Tohu Sofer, a mistake by the Sofer, by the scribe. And there's a whole collection of people whose attempt was. There's all these commentaries on the Talmud that their whole purpose is to just simply say to try to figure out what was the correct text. You know, they'll say, oh, this is incorrect. That's always been a part of Jewish commentary. Part of their commentary is analysis, and part of it is just simply stating what they think the text should actually say, because mistakes have crept into the text. Right? So that's always, so you need a scholar who knows enough that can tell that's not right. You know, that's not the way it's supposed to be. Okay. So that's basically what Shulchan Aruch sets out to do. At the same time that the Shulchan Aruch was writing his... Now, based on what I said, what do you think is going to be one of the major problems of the Shulchan Aruch's approach? Why is it Sephardic? He's Sephardic, so what?
So something might have been different for Ashkenazi.
He's taking majority rule.
Yeah, he chose to be particular.
What?
He chose to be particular.
So which, yeah, so?
That would be a problem.
Why?
Why?
What are those sources? So two are Sephardic, one are Ashkenaz. Right? Rabbeinu Asher is Ashkenaz. The Rif and the Rambam are Sephardic. And generally speaking, the Rif was really influential in the Rambam. So whatever you're going to find in one, you're going to find in the other. So what it basically meant is usually what's going to guide his approach is going to be the traditions of Spanish Jewry. Nothing wrong with that, but that's what his text more reflects. They were the great scholars. You know, certainly you look at the early period, the Sephardic Jewish community was the primary Jewish community. Probably in the Middle Ages, 90% of Jews were Sephardic Jews. The Ashkenazi Jewry will develop over time, will grow, and for different reasons, you know, after expulsions from Spain and things like that, eventually Ashkenazi will grow to the point that it, you know, becomes half the community is Ashkenaz, half the community is Sephardic. But, you know, it makes sense. Those are the giants. You know, those were the major giants, the Rambam and the Rif, and he quotes Rabbeinu Asher. But, as you can imagine, not everyone is going to necessarily feel the same way, right? Certainly if your community is in Ashkenaz, you have different traditions about what the law should be. And that you're going to want to be reflected as well in a code book that you're going to use. So there's a rabbi, Rabbi Moshe Isserles, who lives in Krakow in the 16th century. And he is also writing a commentary or an expansion on the Torah. There's been a couple hundred years since the Torah was written, and he's writing a book called Darchei Moshe, The Way of Moshe. His name was Moshe Isserles. And he's writing this, and all of a sudden he gets a copy of the Bet Yosef in the mail. Right, the Bet Yosef has already done it, collected all these things together. So Darchei Moshe sits down, or Moshe Isserles sits down and says, should I write this, or should I keep writing, or shouldn't I? So he basically decides the following. He says, I'm going to keep writing my commentary for three reasons. One, the Beit Yosef is very elaborate, right? He goes into the discussion. He says, you know, my Darchei Moshe is more concise. So he says, for that reason, I want to keep writing it. He says, also, I want it to be more comprehensive. Because, you know, there's certain important Ashkenazi poskim from the last couple hundred years that the Beit Yosef doesn't conclude. Maybe he wasn't familiar with them. Who knows, right? They're not part of his collection of stories. He says, I think they should be part of the collection. And third is methodology. He says, I don't really agree with his approach to Psak. Not only because, oh, I don't like those choice of those three, but because he doesn't like the choice of any three. He says, since when is that the way that we come to legal decisions? He says, the way we come to legal decisions, or at least one other approach, is, and we've heard this before, is that you do it based on the most recent. Right? Those that have come more recently, who are familiar with the older ones, so their word is going to have greater authority. Those are going to have greater authority. We mentioned that's one of the reasons the Babylonian Talmud is considered more authoritative than the Jerusalem Talmud, is because it was written later. So those who wrote the Babylonian Talmud knew the Jerusalem Talmud. If they concluded differently, they did it because they knew that and they decided to not accept it and to write something else. So he says, when it comes to legal decisions, we don't just, you know, take two out of three. We look at the more recent legal decision makers and we follow suit. We take their lead in how it is that we're supposed to conclude. So, for those three reasons, he didn't totally buy into the Beit Yosef's approach. And so he wrote his Darchei Moshe Also, a commentary, you can open up the Torah on the page. You can see the Torah written. You can see the Beit Yosef. You can see the Darchei Moshe, as well as a couple of others, right, that appear on that page. He then goes ahead and gets a copy of the Shulchan Aruch. That's basically a code based on the Beit Yosef. And so he figures, well, you know what, I'm going to have to now also write a code as well. But he says, in general, Beit Yosef is a big Torah scholar, right? Rabbi Yosef Karo is a big scholar. I don't need to write a whole separate code. He says, you know what, I'm just going to write a gloss to his code. I'm going to write a gloss which is called the Mapa, which means the tablecloth. Right, I mentioned, right, the Shulchan Aruch is a set table. So I'm going to make the tablecloth, right, just the fine trimmings to it. His Mapa tends to do a couple of things. He presents when he disagrees. There's a particular halakha that Shulchan Aruch presents. He disagrees because there's a different approach within tradition within the Ashkenazi communities. He'll present it there. Sometimes something the Shulchan Aruch he feels is vague, so he'll use a language which is more precise to clarify simply what the Shulchan Aruch says. And sometimes he'll want to add something. He'll say, oh, you know, this topic wasn't addressed, so he's going to add to it, you know, just an additional line that Shulchan Aruch wouldn't necessarily disagree with. It just, he didn't address it, for example. And so he adds that as well. As we're going to talk about, in general within Eastern Europe, there was actually a hesitation against writing legal things. There was a sense of, you know, that it's almost like a lack of humility. Like, who are you to write a legal code? The rabbis who would write sometimes responsa, and they didn't keep copies. They felt like, well, they're keeping for posterity copies of it. And so in general, there was a movement against this. Rav Schiller seems to have done this somewhat reluctantly, but in general, it wasn't a major thing happening in Eastern Europe. This approach of writing these code words, at least at that time. And so together, the Mapa and the Shulchan Aruch became this really important legal document. It presented things clearly and concisely, but there also was the sister texts that explained the reasoning and the sources behind it, written as a commentary on the Torah, written in the Beit Yosef and the Darchei Moshe. And so it, in a sense, solved the problem. You had something that was organized based on topic and subject matter. You had all the sources listed, but the sources are listed separately from the code itself so that the code could still be written as clearly and as directly as possible without being overcomplicated by quoting all the different sources. It could simply be the conclusions, but again, the conclusions aren't divorced from the debate, because in the book next door to it, you can get it. And actually, sometimes in yeshivot, people who are studying halakha, they actually will sell editions of a topic of halakha, where top part of the page will be the Torah and the commentaries, and the bottom page will be the Shulchan Aruch. And that way, you don't have to open up two volumes, you can actually in one volume see all the codes together. If not, you have two books, right? And you just flip back and forth between them. And it's because these texts really go together. And in that way, it was this great work that came together. And this will be the primary code. The things we're going to talk about next week, we'll see are how they're sort of built upon this and how their reactions to it and so on. But let me just sort of conclude.
What was the role, was there a role of precedent in any of the recent methodology that...
What kind of precedent?
Like the United States, we base a lot of our decisions on legal precedents.
So that's a great question. I'm going to save that for the course when we actually talk about how Jewish law works. Right? That's just like two. That's a whole course, a whole class on that topic. Right? Right? That, I mean, that's how does the legal system work? How the system works, we'll talk about later. I just can't do it on one foot. Okay. So just sort of to conclude, what we've looked at is this evolution of codes, sort of this experimentation with different ways of writing codes, problems that each code really seemed to have. But because of the mistakes of different generations, or because people wrote them and then people reacted to them, basically allowed for eventually for the tweaking of the approach that results in the Shulchan Aruch, where you, as we said, he basically says, I'm going to write a code and I'm going to write a commentary. I'll separate the two, but they'll be able to support each other. And in that way, that was the winning approach that allowed it to be accepted and respected as an important text. One of the things we saw was the development of the Sephardi Ashkenazi divergence. We have communities living in different places. Communication isn't necessarily so easy. In general, you can see there isn't this strong sense, at least at the point up until we've really spoken about, of divert, right? When the Yosef Karo writes his code, he says, I'm going to take 2 out of 3. Now, we might say the 2 out of 3 lean towards Sephardic, but one of the people he's recognizing is Ashkenaz. So there isn't this kind of approach that says, you know what, I'm Sephardic, I'm only going to look at Sephardic poskim. There isn't like that sense, like, oh, that's a great rabbi, that's a great rabbi. Let's take the consensus about their approaches. It's going to be now that there's going to be this strong, you know, this greater stirring of, there's been all these codes written, that really now you start to see that, no, there is a sense of, you know what, certain traditions or approaches have kind of come developed in one area, and other areas developed in another area, and like each community is going to want their particular traditions reflected within the code. And so that's sort of what you have in the Shulchan Aruch, is you'll have both of those traditions being reflected together, and is allowed right to today that you have Ashkenazim will go to their Ashkenazi rabbis, Sephardim go to the Sephardic rabbis to figure out what their halakha is. I don't think it would be great if we, you know, sort of went back and said, no, let's just look back and figure out, you know, among every subject, which approach makes more sense, and let's just go with that approach. It'd be nice if we all sort of had a general, but, you know, everyone wants to sort of, this is our tradition, the way we've done it. And a sense of, again, sort of that thing we spoke about, you know, who are we to really decide between them if this is what you've been doing? So that's your tradition on how to do things. What we're going to look at, and that sort of leads me to next week, is there then was this process of acceptance of the Shulchan. It didn't happen immediately. Among Sfaradim, it happened fairly quickly. It wasn't immediate, but there was, fairly quickly, it seems to be there was sort of this, again, there were questions among Sephardim about this approach to 2 out of 3, like, what's that? How is that a method in Psak? But there's this tradition that at some point there are 200 rabbis that agreed, oh, we're going to follow it, and so it no longer is 2 out of 3, it's 200 that say that's the way to go. And so it became accepted. Within Ashkenazi communities, the debate really went on for like 100 years about this code, whether this is a code we should basically use. One of the things that helped it was the fact that whenever it disagreed with the Ashkenazi tradition, there were now glosses on it. But still, for like 100 years, again, there was a general aversion in Ashkenazi communities towards these codifications and, you know, again, feeling that it somehow stifled it or, you know, again, you can't know halakha unless you study the Talmud. What does it mean to conclude based on a code book or whatever? There was a general hesitation. Eventually, it's going to be accepted within Ashkenazi communities as well, but that does sort of bring about the debate of then what was going on the next couple hundred years will be more commentaries on the Shulchan Aruch codes and so on, and we'll talk about that period, but then what I want to talk about is really the last 100 years and some important texts that have been written and talk about different approaches to Psak that we start to sort of see, you can still see today, you can see echoes of these debates in the discussion we had today, but I think they continue to exist nowadays for sure as well. So thank you all so much. Yeah.
I have a question. What is the Kitzur Shulchan
Aruch? It's a later code that's written.
Is that really? My understanding was always that it wasn't.
It's not an exact abridgment.
It's not just an abridgment.
Right, exactly. It's not an exact abridgment.
It really kind of went in a different.
Yeah, a little bit, yeah. Exactly, yeah. All right, have a good night.
Bye. I thought your class was going to be